Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the Labour Party choosing their MPs. How do they do it? And how do they decide that they would rather someone else be a candidate at the next election? Esther Giles is in. They're doing trigger ballots right across the country. She's from the Labour Party's Bristol North West branch. Also, John Potash, he's an American author. Drugs as Weapons Against Us is one of his books, but here he reviews a new book out by Tom O'Neill. It's called Chaos: Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 1960s. And then we take a look at the opposite to Extinction Rebellion. In fact, we'll be hearing from a demonstration going on live on the streets of London, a counter-demonstration, not really against Extinction Rebellion, but presenting things in a slightly different way. Jonathan Graham from the Truth Excites blog. And then we hear from someone who's called a climate denier, but he says he's actually just an astrophysicist. Piers Corbyn, the brother of the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, predicting a very cold winter ahead. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show. Could you introduce yourself and tell us what your role is in the party?
Esther Giles. I'm a CLP secretary.
So that's Constituency Labour Party. Yeah. What is a Constituency Labour Party? That's just a party grouping of members around a specific
around
MP?
Around a constituency. Around, so in Bristol there are four constituencies.
So Darren Jones is your MP?
Our constituency MP, yes. When
he was initially elected, was it a surprise?
I don't think so. I think that we could see when we were campaigning that the manifesto was tremendously popular. And we had lots of support and people felt quite positive. It's a bellwether seat.
What does that mean?
It means that if, and this is interesting because usually what it means is if there is going to be a Labour government, then the bellwether seat will be Labour. If there's going to be a Tory government, the bellwether seat will be Tory.
Okay.
But in this instance, the bellwether seat went Labour. We didn't quite get a Labour government.
But you had quite a good swing, didn't you?
A really good swing.
Anyway,
yeah.
We got trigger ballots in.
Yeah.
There's not really been a lot of press about this, but it's quite important, isn't it, in the party?
Yeah, so the party is gradually moving towards an open selection process.
So why hasn't there been that in the past? How's it worked in the past?
Well, it's the pressure, I think, has built over a number of years that through conference, people wanting to have the opportunity to select their MP. The view that actually being an MP isn't a career.
Okay, so once someone becomes a Labour MP, they stay a Labour MP until they're either they decide that they've had enough or they get, I suppose, deselected at the ballot box, isn't
Well, there is that, but at the moment there is a trigger process. So if people don't like their MP, they can trigger the MP being deselected. What we have at the moment is a halfway house. So there is a trigger process, but it's for everybody, every sitting MP.
But it doesn't sound very fair. If an MP has campaigned very hard, and particularly in a swing seat like yours, and managed to get in, then you say, oh, actually, we've decided we don't like you anymore. Does it sound fair?
No, it's not really about not liking the MP or not. It's about having an open selection so that the constituency can choose their representative and they may well choose their existing MP. And so they're not saying we don't want you. They're saying we want to go through a democratic process to choose our MP.
Okay,
and
so
it may be you.
So when is it happening?
It's happening over the next 8 weeks, over the next 2 months.
Okay, and so how does it involve ordinary Labour Party members?
So ordinary Labour Party members will be asked to go to branch meetings to vote to say whether or not they want to proceed to an open selection.
Okay, so is that a secret ballot or is it open?
It's a secret ballot, but the number of votes will be made public within the Labour Party.
And those brunch meetings sound like focus groups or something. Are the various MP candidates there, or is that? Do they get a chance to quiz the MP directly?
No. The MPs will not be there, but there will be a statement. There will be a statement from the MP, and there'll be a whip's report, I think, as well.
So the whips will be saying, yes, this MP has done what the leader has told them to. Is that right?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen one of these reports before. It might be whether they turn up, and I don't know.
Okay, so what sort of majority do you need, and who are the various constituencies within the party that could trigger a open selection process?
So the two groups of relevant organisations, there are the branches within the constituency Labour Party. So I'm in Stoke Bishop in Seamills, for example. It's Avon Mad, Lawrence West, and there's Henley's, West Brantrim, and so on. So there are seven branches within the constituency. Each of those branches have an opportunity to vote. And if more than one third of the branches vote for an open selection, there will be an open selection. So if there are seven branches, more than a third means three, because two would be less than a third. And at the same time, the affiliates to the CLP also get to vote. So the affiliates are people like trades unions. And the same rule applies. If more than a third or more of the affiliates vote for an open selection, irrespective of what the branch votes for, then there will be an open selection.
So what other affiliates are there other than trade unions? Are there any?
I think there's an organisation called CERA.
These are the environment people, yes, of some sort. Yeah, okay.
The Jewish Labour Movement, I think, is an affiliate, and a number of trade unions.
So it's quite likely to happen, isn't it? If you've got two completely different constituencies voting and either of them getting a third, it's quite likely, no?
We're talking about branches. So we've got seven branches voting. So three would have to vote for an open selection. And with the affiliates, there are probably about 10 of them. So four of them would have to vote for an open selection.
So is there quite a lot of lobbying going on behind the scenes? I could call it politicking, but
yeah,
that wouldn't
be polite. There is quite a lot of guidance from the NEC about what people can and cannot do. So people can talk about open selection and debate the benefits and disbenefits of open selection, but can't put pressure or cause people to become uncomfortable about the process or the outcome.
What about a snap election? Because you can't organise it quick enough, can you?
No, it'll stop, and we just have to campaign for the MPs that we have.
That is. What about in the mayor elections? How does it work there?
It's a similar process, except that with the mayoral process, I think it was half, not a third, and we had a similar branch process. So we had to go through a voting thing and decide whether or not we wanted open selection, and we decided not to go for open selection in Bristol North West.
So why has the Labour Party decided to do this? Is it because you've got a whole load of old sort of fossil MPs that have been there for years?
I think it's more something that over the years conference has been asking for. And it's about democracy. It's about your MP being accountable and being positively selected each time by the CLP rather than the default of just carrying on.
But there are all these sort of little campaign groups within the party, aren't there, like Momentum? And groups like that might just decide, right, well, we're going to have a couple of MPs and we're just going to make sure that they're not there next time because we don't agree with them. I mean, isn't that quite problematic? When people point to, in the old days, the Socialist Workers' Party militant as being a kind of party within a party.
Yes, I agree, because the actual vote in the branch depends on people turning up. So if people organise really, really hard, then potentially they could, yes, influence the position more than people that didn't try really
hard.
So
why don't you have something like a postal vote or, you know, some sort of remote voting for those that, say, for example, if you're disabled and a Labour Party member, you might not be able to make it?
Yeah, I agree. That's something that needs to be looked at. Maybe some sort of postal voting or digital voting system, but we haven't got that at the moment.
What about the Labour Party's position on Brexit? It seems to change every 5 minutes.
I think the Labour Party's position has been consistent, but there are...
But it hasn't, has it? Because in the general election in 2017, you were saying we were going to back the people's decision to leave the EU, and now we're talking about actually campaigning for Remain, which is not what they...
The Labour Party is not campaigning for Remain. The Labour Party's position is to secure a victory in a general election, negotiate a deal and put the deal to the people. is not the same as campaigning for Remain.
But it is, in a way, because it means that at the moment there won't be an exit from the EU, and also it could be delayed for another number of years. And in fact, there's a lot of people saying, well, actually, there's a whole load of politicians out there that all they really want to do is just kick the can down the road for another 6 months, another year. And that sounds like what you're doing.
It does. I think there is a need for some decisiveness here. I think we just need to get on with whatever we're going to get on with, because the economic uncertainty is going to be just as disruptive as any deal or no deal that we get.
Okay, Esther Giles, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is John Potash, and I wrote two books. The first one was The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, and the second one was Drugs as Weapons Against Us. And the subtitle is long, but it's basically The CIA War on Musicians and Activists. And I made two films based on each book. And the second film is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. You know, that basically Drugs as Weapons Against Us is the study of the CIA's Project MKUltra, which was had 149 sub-projects. And it overlaps the theme of this book, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA.
Okay, and the before we go on to look at this most recent book by Tom O'Neill, can you just, in a nutshell, explain what was the link between drugs and the CIA, the American Intelligence Service? Why were they so interested?
Well, the CIA looked to use drugs as weapons to oppress the masses, to keep the masses in place from, doing good activism. And they used it against many top activists in the 60s. You know, people think that the drug culture just expanding like crazy with all these different drugs becoming so popular is just a natural phenomenon, when a good study of it shows that it actually was planned by the CIA's Project MKUltra in the 1950s and expanded upon and really acted upon in the 1960s. And President John F. Kennedy tried to close that project down. He first, when he came into office, he fired the CIA director and applied his own director, closed Project MKUltra down. They kept it running behind his back. And when it was discovered again, he closed it down a second time. And at that point, they had to change the name to MK Search. But it continued at least until the early 1970s.
So why was the CIA so interested in musicians? Okay, I can understand drugs. You know, that might actually take, for example, targeting the anti-war activists with drugs. But why musicians? And what way did they engage with the musicians?
Well, I think for several reasons. And one is to control, because they're looking to control our hearts and minds. They know they can't control us physically, because the masses outnumber the oligarchs, the wealthiest in the society, who basically founded these U.S. intelligence agencies. And there's 14 plus intelligence agencies in the United States. So they want to control us, get us to control ourselves, whether we realize it or not. And some of their documents talk about the way they want to do this. And one of the ways is to think we want to take drugs and think we like drugs. And so they promoted all these different drugs behind the scenes. And the best way to promote some of these drugs was through the musicians we love. You know, if we think if these musicians we love are into these drugs, then maybe, we'll get into these drugs and we'll try them. Then, sticking a needle in your arm and shooting up heroin does not seem like a natural thing to do. But when you hear your favorite musician like John Lennon is doing it, it makes it a little more, possible that you might try it yourself. And same thing with Kurt Cobain, and same thing with, smoking weed all the time, like Tupac Shakur, or, getting so into, LSD and all these other drugs like John Lennon and Jimi Hendrix. But the hidden history behind these musicians is the fact that they were giving all these drugs up before their deaths. And so when they found that these musicians were threatened to promote sobriety, towards the end of their lives and get more into activism, that's when they did them in.
What one or two top, you think, most suspicious deaths of musicians?
I can't say I know, about most music, suspicious deaths, but I do think that a large amount of them, do fit into this. kind of pattern. And this isn't just a pattern. Of course, this is based on many other people's research also. Now, you know, Fenton Bressler, a longtime attorney and, you know, a columnist in Britain, had spent 7 years investigating what he thought might be the CIA's murder of John Lennon. And I think he did great work with that. Another great music journalist over in England, whose name leaves me at the moment, also wrote a book coinciding with Fenton Bressler's work, but just advancing it a bit more. And, you know, so there's a number of great investigative, you know, projects on each of these musicians. I happen to do, you know, probably the one of the longest investigations on Tupac Shakur, but I also investigated Kurt Cobain and, you know, some top police detective investigated Cobain's death. A top police investigator actually died about 4 years ago that was investigating Tupac Shakur's death, and says his fellow police officers appear to have killed Tupac Shakur. And so, yeah, there's a lot of great research out there on these particular
I'm
musicians.
Just looking through my history book here, and when John Lennon was shot dead, the head of the CIA was none other than George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr. So it's possible then, you seem to be implying here, that he signed that off.
Yeah, I actually don't think he was director of the CIA at that point, but he was director of the CIA in 1976, and he was, you know, obviously high, very powerful. He was the incoming vice president in 1980 when John Lennon was murdered, and so he was very powerful. He was considered the most powerful person in the country. You know, he was much more powerful than the president, Ronald Reagan. It was similar to Cheney and Bush. Cheney was considered the real president, not, you know, George Bush Jr. And so, yeah, George Bush Sr. was very, you know, definitely headed U.S. intelligence in various ways, even when he stepped down as director of the CIA in 76.
Okay, well, let's recycle back in time a bit to the Manson era. For those that haven't come across Charles Manson before, can you just sort of sum him up? Who was this guy? I know he was considered to be pretty crazy, dark-haired guy, seemed to sort of live in a cult somewhere in California, and he was responsible for various murders, a kind of death squad, effectively.
Right. So, yeah, what was considered the definitive book on Manson was written by a guy named Victor Bugliosi. And it was called Helter Skelter. And he was written by the prosecutor of the Manson, you know, murders, who put Manson and a lot of his followers behind bars. But Tom O'Neill first just wanted to write a kind of an update on, and he actually was assigned this. He didn't even want to do this article when he was first assigned this, to do an update on the Manson murders for like the 20th anniversary. But Manson was an orphan. He bounced around in different orphanages, you know, and then he ended up in jail for a long time. And he comes out of jail in his early 30s, and he ends up leading a harem of women and some men that went on a killing rampage and killed at least 8 people in 2 Hollywood homes, and killed some other people too. But these 2 homes were particularly important. The one home actually was particularly important because it was Sharon Tate's home, and she was a movie star. She was Roman Polanski's wife, and they were holding actually a lot of activist meetings in that home. They were holding meetings that supported the Black Panthers, that supported the anti-war movement. And, you know, they call, actually, some of these actors called themselves, you know, members of groups called the White Panthers in their solidarity with the Black Panthers. And so that was part of the reason, part of the motive for getting rid of these musicians. But I think there was other motives too. And Tom O'Neill exposes a lot of that when he ended up investigating this whole situation for 20 years and interviewed over 1,000 people and got many U.S. intelligence documents on everything that happened.
So what then did Charles Manson go on to do after these murders? He was locked up. But is there any actual evidence that the state was involved, or was he just a nutcase?
Well, there is evidence that the state was involved, and, you know, the state being U.S. intelligence. And some of the – now, he bases – the title of the book, again, is Chaos, and that was based on the Operation Chaos, which was one CIA operation that – New York Times veteran journalist Seymour Hersh found was used against citizens of the United States, you know, activists. It was used against anti-war activists. So here was the CIA going against their charter. They're not supposed to be allowed to target, you know, U.S. citizens, only supposed to be allowed to spy on foreigners. And they are they're spying one, they're disrupting, and there's even found to be cases of murder of, you know, the CIA against U.S. activists.
But they will say, hang on, this is not us, this is Charles Manson. Is there anything that actually ties him to them?
Yeah, so he was going regularly. He was going practically daily to a San Francisco clinic called the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. And in that clinic was a CIA operative named Dr. Julian West, who had an office in that clinic. And he was regularly going to that clinic where the CIA doctor has an office. And this doctor, Dr. Julian West, was corresponding back and forth with the director of the CIA's Project MKUltra, Sidney Gottlieb. And so Tom O'Neill revealed that all this correspondence between these two, because he was directly working behind the scenes for MKUltra. And so here, you know, here was Manson regularly going there, and this is what, you know, some of what was going on. Now, Tom O'Neill also found that virtually every aspect of the Manson case, from the prosecution, LA, you know, Los Angeles Prosecutor's Office, to the Los Angeles Detective Department, to the people that were dealing drugs, both inside Charles Manson's group and at the Sharon Tate's home, were also working for either the FBI or the CIA. Okay, and so he uncovered, and he got multiple witnesses about these people also working for, you know, U.S. intelligence. He got documents showing the, you know, their histories of, you know, these people working for U.S. intelligence, and these people were also trafficking drugs, a number of them. So that's just some of the evidence of, you know, how Manson
amazing. That's quite a lot, isn't it? Yeah. And it's interesting because John F. Kennedy, of course, was assassinated at the beginning of that century. And he was someone that actually wanted to clean up the CIA or even abolish the CIA, which was set up after World War II. And lots of former Nazis were actually recruited into it. One does wonder if this is really a completely rogue organization that probably isn't achieving anything positive, but it's a place for really genocidal criminals to hide.
No doubt. And yeah, and Project MKUltra had a number of Nazi scientists as part of the program, because they were already using drugs, experimenting with drugs on concentration camp victims to see how they can use them for, you know, for weapons. And so, you know, they just brought their projects into MKUltra and became, you know, some of the lead researchers on the projects before they were kind of operationalized in the 1960s against activists. And so, and even in Tom O'Neill's book, he points out that some of these people that were working with U.S. intelligence were also members of top German companies that were the top supporters of Hitler. So yeah, there are those connections too. And it's very interesting that the Spahn Ranch, where Manson had his harem, was right next to a ranch of a former Nazi supporter who owned the ranch right next door. And so, and it's incredible how Manson and his followers went complete. They would have guns and pull guns on police and fire department people all the time and not be arrested. They were doing whatever they wanted, and they were untouchable until it kind of made the headlines, and there was too much kind of spotlight on them, and they had to start getting arrested after that. But before that, they killed people, they pulled guns on cops, and nobody was touched. The top member in the sheriff's department, you know, ordered that they not be touched, they not be arrested. They just, only thing was supposed to be reported was their activities, but nothing else.
So it sounds a little bit like the Epstein case, one of the central government, one of the government people in the United States said that he was hands off Epstein, and it was only eventually that he looked like he might come to trial, but obviously he didn't. And even now we've got Ghislaine Maxwell, the child sex trafficker. She still seems to be hands off. So what do you think was the actual ultimate purpose of the CIA, assuming that they were controlling Manson? What were they actually up to?
I think there was a number of things they were up to. One of those things they were up to was to get rid of these, to scare these activists, these Hollywood activists, kill some of them that were active. Like Sharon Tate was a serious, activist in the white. She was a part of the White Panthers. scare the others that were involved at that home, because they would meet the White Panthers. You know, it could Warren Beatty, you know, top actor, and other top people in Hollywood would meet at this home and discuss these projects. So it was to scare all of them, for one. Secondly, it was to traffic drugs, and because a number of these people were trafficking drugs. Third, it was to support what was the promotion of drugs, because these women would just go to these parties. They would hang out. They lived. This harem of women lived at Beach Boys' Brian Wilson's home for about 6 months, at least 6 to 12 months, not a real long time, where they would have tons of Hollywood parties, invite all kinds of top musicians there. And they would have, you know, they'd be walking around naked and have orgies. And so they were promoting all kinds of drugs at these parties. And of course, people from all over the world were attracted to these parties. You know, and Dave McGowan actually, in his Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, talked about this more at length. But basically, you know, the Beatles were, you know, kind of intrigued with the Los Angeles scene. They went to a party near that scene, and John Lennon was convinced to try acid a second time when he first was dosed the first time he tried acid, as you probably know from a dentist. You know, George Harrison was, you know, tried it a second time. Ringo tried it the first time.
Sorry, when you
time.
Say dosed, do you mean given it involuntarily? So spiked kind of thing.
Yeah, a British dentist spiked the coffee of John Lennon and George Harrison. So they took it against their will, and John Lennon was furious about it in 65. And George Harrison said that he never even heard of it. What's LSD, he said. And so, yes, that's the way they were introduced to acid. Mick Jagger was introduced to acid by an undercover FBI agent named David Schneiderman, who was also working for MI5 at the time. And so that was in 1967. And that was at a time when the CIA Project MKUltra deputy director, a guy named Robert Lashbrook, brought loads of LSD and loads of agents and money over to London, according to A.E. Hotchner, who was Ernest Hemingway's longtime editor and friend. And he said in his book Blown Away that you know, Lashbrook instructed his agents to get LSD in as many musicians' hands as possible in London. And so first victims were, of course, George Harrison and John Lennon. And the second was, you know, another one was Mick Jagger, obviously.
Just remind us of the title of the book.
So the title of the book by Tom O'Neill about Charles Manson is called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s.
And did you think they achieved chaos? Did they achieve what they really wanted to achieve with it?
Well, I do. I think they did spread. You know, these women were doing all kinds of stuff all around the area for at least about 2 years before they were, you know, a number of them were in prison. But some of them stayed out of prison. And one of them actually tried to assassinate President Gerald Ford when Rockefeller was the vice president. And I think that was to get Rockefeller into the presidency. This is, you know, what they do. I mean, this is she was obviously working on a high level. She got within inches of Ford and with a gun and tried to unload the gun on him, but it jammed on her. So these people were high level operatives. They were actually dissociative. They were suffering from dissociative identity disorder. These girls. These girls were underage girls, as you know, the young as 13 when they were, you know, went through the rapes by Manson and others. And they were, you know, they became robots, basically multiple personality robots, sadly enough, who would do the bidding of, you know, U.S. intelligence. Yeah, so I think they did achieve a lot of different things that U.S. intelligence wanted to achieve before, you know, some of them went to jail and some of them stayed out in jail and kept doing what they wanted to do.
Well, John, keep investigating the dark side of the 60s, because it's fascinating. Gives us quite an insight into you know, the world we're in today and why the United States is like it is. You know, why we're having to deal with, you know, I suppose what is a really failing democracy.
You're right. It is a failing democracy over here, sadly enough. And I'm sorry we're both living in those kinds of democracies right now. I hope things change for the better. We'll see.
And it certainly helps to understand why we are where we are if we're going to change things for the better. John Potash, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Jonathan Graham, and my blog, truthexcites.com is a libertarian blog which takes its name from the idea of a source of information being easily detectable as false or true from the resonance. Rather like when you talk to a person, you know if they're dodgy, you know if you don't believe what they say. And if something is true, then it has a stamp of truth. It has a resonance. It kind of vibrates, it excites.
Many people will say that's exactly what Greta Thunberg has done. She's saying what a lot of people are thinking, which is that there's too much pollution around and the planet is suffering.
Absolutely. And Greta is clearly a very thinking person. I would like to know how she has ended up where she is and whether she is just a PR mascot. And actually, as a human being with the brain, which she clearly is, being abused by the George Soros-funded Extinction Rebellion.
And what evidence What evidence have you got that George Soros, who he was the guy, amongst other things, he's made a lot of money from Black Wednesday.
Black Wednesday.
And other things. What evidence is there that he's funding people like her?
Well, if you look into the generation of Extinction Rebellion, and I will need to get some links to hand, I'm on the street just now, you will find that as well as having the small donors who helped its crowdfunding, George Soros is listed with an undisclosed amount. Since we know that he is a billionaire investor, the profiteer from Black Wednesday, who has played a big part in funding NGOs which push the United Nations Agenda 21, Agenda 2030. It doesn't take too many dots to be joined to look at this project. Just as the end of snow was forecast, the polar vortex came. The polar vortex hit America. It hit Eurasia and Russia. It hit Australia. Since 2010, 2011, when we had a couple of frigid winters in Scotland and Britain, we've had way more frigid winters in America. The grand solar minimum on the sun, the magnetic weakening of the sun, which is a fact that both sides would agree with, has coincided with the plateauing and now falling of world temperatures, apart from the ones which are adjusted up by NASA and which create lies for the BBC to broadcast.
Well, hang on, because many people will say that your figures are less reliable than those of all those scientists which the BBC and other mainstream media are quoting.
Well, that's very interesting. It would be interesting for everyone to know that we use NASA's statistics, but we use NASA statistics before they doctor them, before they deliberately adjust them to heat the present and cool the past. China, number one, are polluting their cities locally, and that's a problem. But number two, they are actually being favoured by a world incentive system which penalises America and the West and has allowed China and India to develop. So China have benefited hugely from the carbon trading system. If we have the restoration of parity, which Donald Trump wants, then we will have a system where Africa is not overcharged for its energy, which keeps Africans in poverty because of the climate con. We will have a system where energy is as affordable for all as it could be. The modern civilization has been built on fossil fuels. They're not perfect, but they're pretty great. There is plenty of them left. Much of the shortage of oil in the ground and coal and gas is exaggerated. We have shale gas. We've got nuclear. We have plenty to keep us going, and it's working pretty well. And we're going into a cooling period. It's important to have cheap energy readily available. And it's important that children should be inspired by the wonder of nature and enjoy the grand solar minimum. I mean, we are at a historic time. We had the Maunder minimum, We had the Dalton Minimum when the River Thames in London froze, and now we're on the verge of another equivalent period. It's exciting. I'm glad to be alive now.
Okay, so when these extremes of weather, when can we expect those, if what you say is correct?
Well, we've had a taste already. There are 11-year cycles in the sun. The last maximum was 2013-14. The last minimum was 2009 to 2013. So think back to how cold the winters were then. They were pretty cold. We had the coldest December on record, 2010. So that was a little foretaste of it. America is a continental climate, so it cools more quickly. It's also the part of the jet stream going from Alaska to Florida makes America feel it first. They've had very cold winters for the past 10 years, pretty much. Britain had a lull in the cold from 2013 to 2017, partly because of the precession of the moon as well. But the last few years have been getting a little bit colder in Britain, and now this winter should be quite a lot colder. And from 2020 to 2025, we should go down fast. It should get colder. Then might warm up a little bit with a small maximum, 25 to 30, and then after 2030, it will be seriously cold.
Okay, well, there's one prediction you can't unsay.
I can't unsay, I don't want to.
Jonathan Graham, can you just give the audience a little idea of whereabouts to find some of your take on the whole climate and the links to the sun online?
Absolutely. TruthExcite.com has some articles. At TruthExcite on Twitter is where I'm very active. Please come and join the debate. NoTrickZone.com, the real climate science blog.com, whatsupwiththat.com, I think it's .com, but just Google it. It's spelled WATTSUP with that. The Global Warming Policy Forum, which was set up by Nigel Lawson, it's not completely trustworthy, but it's interesting. It's run by someone called Benny Pizer. Other climate science blogs, real climate science blog, we've got What's Up With That, we've got the Twitter feed, @Tony_Heller on Twitter,
and
@ActionForLife_, @Piers_Corbyn, weatheraction.com. This climate change project has been in existence for so long in different forms. Al Gore in 1989, the Rio Summit in Brazil in 1992, and Agenda 21, which was the United Nations plan for the 21st century. And now that global cooling has replaced global warming and that predictions are not coming true, they're going for this with such urgency because they know that in a few years, the climate will have clearly proved them wrong and people won't stand for it. So they're doubling down like anything now.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hello, I'm Piers Corbyn. I'm a long-range weather forecaster and astrophysicist. I forecast the weather months or years ahead using our understanding of solar activity, that is, particles from the sun and how they interact with the Earth's magnetic field and atmosphere. And we understand some of the cycles in these connections, which enable us to make long-range or very long-range, you might say, forecasts of weather and climate.
OK, what about this winter then?
Well, this winter, this late autumn, November and December are going to be, generally speaking, extremely cold and snowy in Britain and Ireland. January and February, we haven't completed the forecast yet for those yet, but there's more variability then, that is for sure. And if you want the details, they will all be available shortly, and the December is available now on weatheraction.com.
When you talk about solar cycles, how often is a solar cycle and what is it?
Well, there are many cycles of activity on the Sun or in Sun-Earth connections. For example, solar flares have a sort of periodicity of 155 days. This is big explosions on the Sun. And
so you're saying that one happens every 155 days?
Well, it's not exactly clockwork, but there is a tendency for that. Yes.
Okay, so what we can maybe extrapolate from that is that there is a sort of, I don't know, whatever, like a pressure underneath the surface of the Sun, and that every 155 days, roughly, it needs to be released.
Yes, if you like, but there's many other things going on the Sun. There's many other cycles as well. There's a 27.2-day modulation of the Sun-Earth connections due to the Moon crossing the orbit of the Earth, intervening the rush of particles from the Sun.
Now, it's obviously very, very hot, but what's it actually doing on the surface of the Sun?
Well, and there's also an 11-year cycle and 22-year cycles and so on. There's lots of cycles, that's what I'm pointing out, and we understand a bit about these and when they're going to repeat their patterns again. What is actually going on underneath the surface of the Sun? Well, actually, there are many theories, but there's a lot of inadequacies in the theories. But certainly we have strong magnetic fields underneath the surface of the Sun, which break out in places. And those are called sunspots when they break out. So they're actually slightly cooler regions, although the edges of them are hotter. And particles get ejected from sunspots. And another phenomenon that happens, which is related, is that the solar corona, if you like, can have gets holes in it. And that is the very thin, very hot cloud surrounding the Sun, which is very large, and you can see it during eclipses, for example. That can get holes in it called coronal holes, and when those happen, you get very fast electrons emitted.
So is it a nuclear reaction going on the surface?
Well, no. The theory is there's nuclear reactions in the deep in the core of the Sun, although there's other theories around as to having the Sun may have a more electrical nature. But whatever, there are things certainly going deep down inside the Sun and just below the surface.
I mean, is it something burning? Whatever's burning must have a fuel of some sort, surely, to give off all that
heat. Yeah. Well, nuclear fusion, of course, would be a fuel. That's the standard theory of star formation.
But, and here's a big but, and I know you're not an astrophysicist, are you?
I am an astrophysicist.
Right, well, maybe you can help us with this one, though. Okay. Because surely, if it was a sort of nuclear reaction going on the surface mm-hmm. of the Sun, then the Sun would just burn up within a few seconds and there'd be a massive explosion.
No, isn't it? It's a slow process of nuclear fusion in the core of the Sun, where it's hotter. But there are people who dispute this theory and suggest that actually all the stars are connected by electric circuits, which are called Birkeland currents, which are not entirely invisible and are becoming more visible. But these could be providing power to stars, which are all connected together, you know, and the sources could be bigger stars and so forth. But this is, as I say, just a vague hypothesis. I'm just saying that just to point out that, you know, not everything is understood about the Sun, and there are alternative theories around. I'm not saying they're right, but it should all be investigated.
Okay, how about the sunspot cycle? You mentioned briefly various different cycles. Well, that's obviously quite important, since we know that sunspots affect weather here.
That's right. The sunspot cycle is 11 years, but the more important cycle is the double sunspot cycle, i.e. 22 years, because the sunspot's magnetism changes direction, or the magnetic field of the Sun changes direction every 11 years. So every 22 years, you're going to have a strong magnetic field in the same direction. And that, in fact, gives us a main signal of temperatures in the Earth of a 22-year cycle.
So how long does it take for this various material? Obviously, light travels pretty fast, but for the various material ejected by the sun, how long does it take for it to arrive on the Earth's atmosphere?
It takes about... the light takes 8 minutes, and the particles on average take about 4 days to come from the sun to the Earth, and they go at about 1,000,000 miles an hour. But some of them travel much faster, you know, even at half the speed of light, and others slower. Average speed time is about 4 days.
Do you think there's any kind of real big shocks? Because over the years we've had various strange weather conditions, like there was the, I believe it was a medieval warm period, and back in the 1600s, there was the River Thames froze over, that sort of thing. What kind of, is that likely to ever happen again? And if so, when?
Yes, when? It is. Well, it would have happened in 1963 or even part of the time. 2 winters ago, if the Thames wasn't dredged, because the Thames used to be in London basically a swamp. I mean, Bermondsey, it was called Bermondsey because it was a sea, there's various things called Lower Marsh near Waterloo because it was a marsh, you see, and the roads around Elephant and Castle are called Newington Causeway because it was a causeway through the marsh. So the whole of that area was swamp and very shallow. So it was pretty easy for it to freeze over when it was very cold. And London Bridge then was basically a dam with holes in. So it was, you know, in a different scenario. Then the Thames froze over relatively easily, and it froze over a lot of times during the 1600s. But in that time, there was also some very hot summers. All this was to do with what we call the wild jet stream, the upper air changing its path in quite extreme manner.
Well, hang on, because surely this is just a theory. How on earth do you know what the jet stream was doing in the 1600s?
Well, we can tell because there were... for example, the Great Fire of London was preceded by the Belgian Wind, which was a very hot wind coming from what was then called Belgium, which was mostly in northern France. It was a hot southeast wind because the jet stream was fixed, so to speak, or pretty static, and had a long stream coming from the south to the north, which made it very, very hot. And then in the following winter, we had the opposite happening again, a long, wildly meandering jet stream, which brought extreme cold and what we call the ice age, another ice age winter there, mini ice age winter, when the Thames froze over that winter and the winter before, and a whole number of winters around then. It was in what was called the Maunder minimum of solar activity and a little ice age. But these little ice ages do include some relatively short, hot blasts in summers.
What about the whole situation now with the melting ice cap? Is that caused by global warming or by the sun?
Well, it's not true. What you're told is lies. The ice cap is not melting. What's actually happening now is the area covered by snow on an annual basis, the biggest area extent of snow in the Northern Hemisphere, is getting bigger. This year's maximum snow extent was the biggest for 50 years. The BBC report only little stories where bits of it are melting, which of course they do.
Well, all I'd say is, I mean, a lot of people are saying the opposite to this, Piers. Where would you point people? Hang on. Where would you point people to get this information about the increasing snowfall?
Well, you can go on a large number of websites, but I would suggest go to the best guy who's monitoring lots of data is Tony Heller, whose website, or rather Twitter feed, is Steve S. Goddard, G-O-D-D-A-R-D. And you can get all the links there. Or come to weatheraction.com, and there's plenty of links on our site. Actually.
Now, this is a difficult question to ask you, but how successful have your forecasts been over the last few years, Piers?
About 85%. This is independent. We've had peer-reviewed assessment of our forecasts, and they're hardly skilled. There's no other long-range forecasters with peer-reviewed success reports. at all.
Okay, so from looking outward, let's just take a quick look in. What about Brexit? Is it going to happen or not?
Well, this afternoon is a political question rather than a scientific question. But I would say Brexit should, must, and will happen. And the next question is when. Well, I don't know. It's a question of the ever postponement, isn't it? But maybe it will happen on the 31st of October. I hope so, and then we could get on with talking about the politics of the country and people's wealth distribution and so forth, instead of these endless arguments.
Okay, Piers Corbyn, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Cheers, Piers. That's lovely.
Okay.
All the best.
I hope that'll do.
Cheers.
Yeah, all the best, Tony. Ta-da. Good to hear from you always.
All the best. Ta-da. Bye.
Oh, by the way, yeah? I was, did you know, I gave a summary, like you did, at the Glastonbury Symposium, and it went down a storm.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I was sort of, because when I gave my little prediction last year, I was saying, well, yes, it will happen, but it'll be a terrible crash of some sort. So I was kind of wrong, but I mean, I think ultimately it will. It's just a question of there really.
I mean,
have you seen, by the way, one of the most, I think, shocking things about all of this, apart from, did you see the use of Rees-Mogg using the word Illuminati to describe Letwin last
did
week?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Check that out. Just Google that. Letwin and Illuminati. Yeah, he actually used that word. It will be in Hansard. I used it on the radio last week. Because it was, he was accusing them of being. I know, amazing, amazing. But
things are coming out of the woodwork.
Well,
or else they're making them up. Who knows? But you know, this
well, it was a very, you know, obviously, you know, he's a Catholic, as was Robeson that wrote the book about the Illuminati, the Scottish engineer. So I think he's really, but anyway, I mean, this whole business, it seems to me, is designed as a sort of, like the whole European project, is they're not really interested in just controlling Europe. They want to seed as much chaos on the way as possible. And I think they know that people are not going to let them take over 100%, but they know also that they can create absolute mayhem.
Yeah,
on the way to doing that.
Well, there's mental mayhem and political mayhem, but I think the trading mayhem, I don't think that is real at all. I think
no.
See, that is their problem. Well, when you know, on day one afterwards, people are going to say, "Notice the sky's still there. The price of butter is the same. People might be buying Somerset brie instead of French brie, but who cares? You know, I mean, that's what I think it'll be like. A Y2K moment."
Okay, mate. Take care.
All right.
Cheers. All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests. That's Esther Giles from Bristol North West Labour Party, US author John Potash, from the Truth Excites blog Jonathan Graham, and you just heard there from Piers Corbyn, brother of the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, who has a business predicting the weather, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.